Good evening, everybody. I thank Lee for introducing me, but that's the least of it. She's also feeding me and putting me up over the weekend, so thanks for that, she and Joe. And thanks to Sims for inviting me up. I feel like part of family. I feel coming home when I come back and address a Sims audience, and thanks to Nalanda West for, I don't know if Nalanda West co-sponsors the talk or just gives space for it. Anyway, I think it's on the Nalanda West website, right? So thanks for that. Well, it's nice to sit. Huh? I always forget that sitting is involved in this these evenings. So. Cools me out, you know. this is a busy time of the year for religious people. The summer is over and retreats begin. And in Zen we have tradition of ango, or practice period. So we always have that in the fall. It starts just around the end of August, beginning of September, and runs through middle or end of October. So we just started that, and we have lots of people participating in retreats and special classes and making extra commitments to sit a little bit more and study a little bit more and be connected to each other a little bit more during this time. And also, it's the time of the year in Judaism when you go to synagogue a lot, and kind of it's a time of year for facing yourself and facing the divine and taking stock. Where have I been and where am I going, and can I return to my true heart? It seems like this is a reality of the religious life, don't you think, that sometimes we really feel connected to our practice and we're right there, even if it's not always easy. Other times we drift away and we forget about it, and other things are, you know, we're busy, and then we come back. So this is a good time of year for coming back. And also, today is September the 10th, and tomorrow will be September the 11th. And I don't know what September 11th is exactly, or nationally, what it means to us, and what kinds of, and what it will become, you know, in the future. But it does seem, I mean, it falls in this same time of year, a time for grieving, and a time for remembering. Maybe, I hope, it also is or will be a time for soul searching and investigation, as all grieving is, right? Whenever you're in, have a grieving time, you think of your loss, but also you think, well, what does my life mean? What are we doing here on the planet? That's what grieving does to you if you pay attention to it. So it always upset me that in September 11th, 2001, we didn't do that. We didn't say, let's take stock. What does this mean to us, to our life, to our way of life? But maybe now we're ready to start that process of, in September 11th, we can all take stock of ourselves as a nation and see, you know, what in our grief, you know, how are we doing? How could we be more, could we be more serious, you know, about our national life? Could we have more fairness and justice in our country, more compassion? Would be nice if we all assess that this time of year. Anyway, so that's what I've been up to lately. And this is the time of year for it, for me, maybe for you too. So I thought tonight I would talk a little bit about a Zen text that we're using as the theme for our practice period at home. It's a text by a Zen master Dogen called Bodhisattva's Four Methods of Guidance. And the four methods of guidance are giving, kind speech, or generosity, you know, giving, generosity, kind speech, beneficial action, and what he calls identity action. But before I get into the text itself, I want to kind of introduce it in what might perhaps be a roundabout way, in the hopes that I eventually will get to the text before. How long am I supposed to talk? I forgot. Somebody told me. 45 minutes, is that right? Is that what you said? Somebody said. Where is Pat? There, here you are, Pat, yeah. 45 minutes and then questions. So that we be sure to go home at 9 so we can get our beauty sleep. Okay. One of the features of a Zen practice period, or ango, is that it has a head monk. And that's a person who's sort of designated to occupy that role, and that person is sort of almost like the icon of the practice period. And we all look to that person for a tone and a spirit for that particular practice period. So this time we have a wonderful practitioner who's been practicing a long, long time as head monk, and he came to me and he was worried because he said, my mother-in-law is 99 and she recently took a turn for the worse. And I'm afraid that what if something happens to her during the practice period and I have to, you know, absent myself? That would be terrible. Maybe I shouldn't do it. So I thought it over and I said, well, no, why don't we just get your mother-in-law to join the practice period? And then if she joins and she is part of the practice period, if something happens with her, it'll just be part of the practice period. You know, that's how you handle things in practice. You know, whatever the problem is, you just bring it into the practice. You don't say, well, this is a problem, I have to get rid of this so I can practice. That doesn't make any sense, does it? No. So you say, well, let's bring the problem right into the middle of the practice. So I had a talk with her. And I said, what do you think, you know? And she said, oh, yeah, okay, that would be a good idea. So every week we get reports from her how she's doing, and it's not that well, actually. You know, it's hard being 99 and not having... she was has been pretty healthy and pretty altogether there. But no, not so much, so it's hard. But then I thought, well, but... why should we just limit it to her? Many other people in the practice period also have elderly parents that they're taking care of. And so why don't we bring all that into the practice period too? So we're actually taking time to really reflect on and take into our hearts at the center of the practice this problem that we all have eventually, if we're lucky. That is, we get old and we die and maybe we're not that old now, maybe we're old enough to have very elderly parents, and as I say, many people do. So we're bringing all of this into the practice period and telling lots of stories and commiserating with one another. So I'll tell you some of the stories that have been going on, just so you know. One of our practitioners from the Northwest here, she has elderly parents, and this amazingly awful event happened to them. They were fine living together in their home, and one day a neighbor came in and found them both unconscious on the kitchen floor. And they had been that way apparently for a few days, and I guess one of them had gone into the kitchen and stumbled and fell, and the other one got all excited and went to pick up the phone to call, you know, for an emergency, and then that one fell on top of the other one, and they were both knocked out, and nobody there to look after them, so finally a neighbor did come in. But that, as often happens with elderly people, that one incident took them down several pegs in their health, and her father died fairly recently, and her mother is in a state of fairly acute dementia, so that even though our friend's sister moved in with the mother to take care of her, the mother thinks that she's being held prisoner against her will, you know, by the sister, who's desperately trying to be kind and sweet, and, you know, and the mother is paranoid about it. Pretty sad story. Pretty difficult. We have a wonderful Everyday Zen student who lives in San Antonio, Texas. And his own story is really pretty amazing, but I don't have time to tell you his story. But he's married to a Japanese woman, and they're maybe in their late 60s. And her mother is still alive in Japan in her late 90s. I've never met her, but to hear them talk about her, she's a very tough old lady, really tough lady. She was widowed as a young woman and had to make her way running a business, taking care of young children. And this made her, you know, a very tough person and mean, according to them. And she's famous in the family for being fierce. You know, everybody's scared of her, even though she's 95 or 97 or something like that. So she has this funny habit of almost dying. She's always almost dying. And Shigemi will have her bags packed, you know, in San Antonio, waiting to go to Japan for the last days of her mother. And then she has the bag packed, and then not today, and not next week. And then finally she unpacked her bag. Her mother seems to be too stubborn to die, you know, that quickly. And apparently, you know, not dying anytime soon. I have this same situation actually in my own family. My mother and father-in-law, who are in their, my father-in-law is now in his early 90s, and my mother-in-law is in her late 80s, and they've been living in their own house, somehow managing to survive on their own, even though he's got Alzheimer's disease. She somehow manages to take care of him and take care of the house and all that. But this is now changing quickly. Different things are happening, and we have to figure out an alternate plan. So this is not fun to hear about this, is it? You don't like hearing about this. I don't like hearing about it. But it actually is real. You know, it happens. And many people have this situation. And in our Sangha at home, there are even those of us who are themselves elderly, you know, now in their 80s. And after being pretty robust and strong for all that time, now beginning to notice, oh, the hearing is not so good anymore. And that makes a big difference in terms of one's ability to interact with other people and feel part of a social group. If you can't hear very well, it makes it hard. So here's an email that I got from this is from the wife of our head monk, talking about her 99-year-old mother. I told her that you thought, me, I thought that it might be helpful for her to think about one thing, like her relationship to food or sleep, or a particular train of thought, like complaining, for instance. And pay attention to that one thing for her work, for the practice period. That'll be her practice, you know. Pay attention to your sleeping, or pay attention to your eating, or pay attention to one particular train of thought. So she used the word relationship, your relationship to food, your relationship to sleep, your relationship to a particular train of thought. And all of a sudden, her mother, hearing this, launched into a story about a relationship that she had with a friend named Margarita when she was young. And Ruth, the daughter, writing the email, said, "This at first, this threw me off. Like, why is she all of a sudden talking about this relationship with a friend of hers so many years ago?" And she realized that it was probably the word relationship that set her off into this story. Anyway, she said, as if it happened yesterday, that she and Margarita were sitting with their arms around each other one day, and the very next day, Margarita got polio and her life changed completely. They were 16 at the time, and probably because of her illness and because of her being less likely, I guess, to marry as a result of this illness, and because of the increasing presence of the Nazis, because this is happening in Germany and these are Jewish people, because of all of this trouble, Margarita took her life, probably by age 20. I remember Mom telling me her best friend had killed herself, but I don't remember hearing about the polio. Although Mom did not make the connection between Margarita's sudden change in physical condition and her own, I'm sure it was there. So I told that story to the people in our practice period as part of our reflection on this issue. And it struck me as really kind of interesting. I think it's possible that a feature of extreme old age might be an intense and deep relationship to memory and to the past. Of course, we all understand this, but it may be more profound a thing than we think. The past is always changing. It doesn't remain the same. A few years ago or last year or something like that, we were studying a text of Dogen, another text of Dogen called Ujik, Being Time, in which he talks about this nature, this changeable nature of time and how the past changes. It's like when you go on a hike and you pass landscape. In your mind, it's as if the landscape is always the same behind you. But of course, the landscape has its own life and it's changing behind you, just like the past has its own life and it's changing behind you. And I was telling this to someone in the Jewish meditation intensive that we were having this time of year. I'm still in the midst of that, as well as the everyday Zen practice period. I was telling this to a man in the intensive. And this man had lost his 13-year-old daughter in a traffic accident many years ago. And I don't really know the circumstances, but in his mind, he's absolutely sure that it was really his fault, that he was negligent, and that that's why his daughter died. And it's been stuck inside of him in a painful way for about 15 years. And when I told him that actually, you know, the past is not fixed, it's fluid, it changes, just like everything else. The past changes if we will allow change to take place. He was pretty startled by that idea. I think in extreme old age, when there literally is not a future anymore, because I think the future is not an actual time that's coming. The future is a feeling that we have about our present lives. You don't necessarily think about it, but the way you feel about your life right now has to do with the fact that you feel pretty certain you'll be here tomorrow and next week, next year, 5 years from now. That conditions the way you live in the present moment. Well, if you're 99, you don't have that feeling anymore about your life. And I think when there's no future, your feeling for the present moment changes and becomes, the past becomes thicker and more present in the present moment. And maybe this is one reason why it seems like old people often get demented. They may not actually be demented, it's just that they are now living in a totally different time frame from the rest of us. And from the conventional point of view, that time frame doesn't make sense. It sometimes doesn't make sense to them either, because they expect to live in the same time frame as everybody else. And somehow in my mind, you know, this connects to the way of looking at life that Dogen is suggesting in this text that I may or may not get around to talking about tonight, the four methods of guidance. So now I want to tell you about a trip we took to Japan, which also relates to this text. Now, I don't know what you think about Zen, you know, Buddhism. If you've ever done Zen Buddhist practice in Japan or Vietnam or China or the United States or Canada or Europe or somewhere. But I think that people in the West don't have a very good idea about what Zen practice is really like. Because mostly we know about it from books. And books are always, you know, about doctrine or history. They're, you know, of necessity somewhat idealistic about ideas. And they kind of create a kind of flavor that looks like a Zen. It's a literary flavor because books, generally speaking, are made up of words. And words seem to be about something other than words, which often makes you lose sight of the fact that they actually are words. And then there are the various American Zen centers, the founders of which often read those books too, and try to recreate in their centers a kind of way of practice that matched what those books were saying. All of this is really different from what you will find in Japan if you live a Zen life in Japan. Especially Soto Zen life. You know, Soto Zen is the kind of Zen that we practice. And Soto Zen was the Zen of farmers and villagers, not the Zen that's much more famous that was associated with the samurai and the ruling classes. Soto Zen is a much simpler, quieter Zen, much more warm and friendly and informal. Although it's not friendly and warm in the way that we would think of friendly and warm. Because Japanese people, Japanese culture, is much more indirect than ours and much more quiet. And it often expresses deep feeling by saying nothing about it, just by feeling the feeling. With the understanding that if you're feeling something deeply, others will know that you're feeling something, and it is much more intimate for others to know that you're feeling something just by knowing it than to go around blabbing about it. Speaking about your feelings actually may be less feeling than feeling your feelings. There may actually be a certain kind of abstraction that takes over when you start thinking about what you're feeling rather than feeling what you're feeling. So it is very possible that to a Japanese person, our Western effusion about how we are always saying how we feel and so on, how grateful we are, how moved we are, how sad we are, and so on, I think probably to a Japanese person, this seems like very abstract and distant. Like, if she really felt like that, why would she say that? If she's saying that, she mustn't really be feeling that. When you think about it, it really makes sense. To deeply feel your feelings, you wouldn't be interested in analyzing them or naming them or, like, telling somebody about them. And as I say this, I'm thinking of this wonderful moment as we were leaving. We were staying for about 5 days altogether, a bunch of everyday Zen priests in a temple, a small temple in a small town, which was the original temple of Suzuki Roshi, founder of Zen Center. We were staying there, and we'd been there for a while. And as we left, we were getting on the train and waving goodbye to Shungo-san, who's the grandson of Suzuki Roshi, who takes care of the temple, and his mother. And they were waving goodbye to us. They were behind a big cyclone fence at the train station. And as the train was pulling away, they were pretending to claw at the fence as if to climb over the fence and escape, you know, and jump on the train with us. And then they were wiping, you know, mock tears from their eyes as they did this. And it was very funny and sad and sweet at the same time, and also maybe a little surprising to us, since the whole time we had been there, they had been on the whole fairly reserved, had never expressed anything like this. So we didn't really know how they felt, but they knew exactly how we felt, because we had explained to them many, many times how grateful we were and how moved we were by them and so on and so forth. So they knew how we felt. And it was really fun being at Rinso Inn. The family there is Shungo-san, who's a young priest in his middle 30s, and his wife Kumi-san, and they have the cutest little girl. Her name is Momoya, their daughter. And they live there with his parents. His dad, Suzuki Roshi's son, is the abbot of Rinso Inn, and his wife, Shungo-san's mother, is there taking care of the temple. And that's what they do all day long. They take care. That's what they do. They clean, they arrange flowers, they take care of altars, they meet people who come, they run off with their little Zen bag to do memorial services in people's homes, or sometimes people come to them for memorial services or counseling or just to sit in the Buddha hall. So it's a very busy life, but at the same time very, very quiet. And this family and this temple serves as the center for a fairly large community of lay people who depend on the temple for their religious lives, which to them is the same as their connection to their heritage, to their Japanese-ness, and to their families, their parents and grandparents and ancestors who've passed on, and whose graves are right there in one of the three cemeteries that Rinso Inn takes care of. So there were about, I don't know how many of us there were at that point, maybe 15 or 20 of us there at Rinso Inn, right in the middle of all this life going on. And we felt, you know, like, oh, geez, you know, we must be inconveniencing you. It must be terrible to have us plopped in the middle. I mean, literally, we were in the middle of, you know, this whole life. And it must be, you know, inconvenient, just like I think we would feel if they plopped into the middle of our busy lives, how inconvenient this would be. We would be nice, you know, all this, but it would be inconvenient. And so we kept saying, oh my gosh, we're so sorry, we're, you know, messing you up, and so on and so on. And they kept saying, no, 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 not at all, not at all. The people coming appreciate seeing you here. They appreciate seeing your practice. And anyway, they said, Rinso-in is not our temple. Rinso-in belongs to everyone. It belongs to you. And after a while, it seemed like, yeah, I actually think they mean it. There's a small zendo in Rinso-in, a place to sit, meditation. It seats about maybe a dozen people. Rinso-in is about 500 years old, and the zendo is probably 500 years old as well. And years ago, there were monks training in Rinso-in, but that's over 100 years past since then. So we doubled up on the platforms, and we could sit all of us in there. And so a few people came from the outside to join. One guy would roar up every morning in the motorcycle and get off and sit with us. And then after sitting, we had a morning service with lots of Japanese chanting. And Shungo-san played the drums and the bells and the chanting, and I was the officiant every morning, and we all got better at our Japanese chanting. The rest of the day, while the family was busy with their duties, we made a little monastic schedule for ourselves, which included services and lots of cleaning. Cleaning is the main practice in Japanese Zen, cleaning the temple. So we cleaned, but we also took lots of breaks, tea breaks, and chat breaks. The young monk named Koe-san, who practiced with us at ceremonies we did at the big monasteries, he came to visit us with his mother one day and brought us some eel cookies, if you can imagine such a thing, because his area is famous for eel. Another day, Oksan Suzuki, who is the wife of Suzuki Roshi. Suzuki Roshi died in 1971. Oksan is now in her late 90s also. And to our astonishment, when we called her up, she said she would come to visit us at Rinso-in. We couldn't believe it. We had heard that she's being very quiet now and not really wanting to see people, but she came to visit us. Rinso-in, she came in the door, she didn't look at us at all, she made a beeline for the Buddha hall where she plopped herself down, made prostrations, and began praying very seriously in front of the Buddha, and then stood up and said in a loud voice in perfect English, "Welcome home, welcome home." And we thought at first it was this sort of endearing comment to us, welcome home to you, to Rinso-in. But I think later we figured out that she was probably saying that about herself, welcome home. Because she doesn't go there very often, and she lived there for many years, and that's her place to pray in her spiritual home. So she was probably talking about herself. Then she sat down and talked to us for more than an hour about her life. She said every day she walks around the neighborhood and knocks on the doors of people she knows who live alone and sticks her head in and says, "Hello, how are you?" She lives next door to a school for troubled children. And every day she waves and says hello to the children when they come to school. This is her practice, she said. Also, she writes haiku, and she's a very good singer. And she sang us some songs. So we had a really nice time at this temple, Rinso-in, which is one of my favorite places in the world. We lived together in a quiet atmosphere, all the men sleeping in one room, side by side on the floor, and all the women sleeping in another room. And we lived lives of essential kindness. A life that was automatically, without thinking about it, without needing to name it, a life of giving, a kind speech, a beneficial action, an identity action. We didn't need these words. You didn't need to think about these concepts. Everyday life just was that. Then we spent some time in the big monasteries, the big training monasteries, very strict. You know, I did some ceremonies there, as I mentioned, with Koei-san, and, you know, very complicated, details, how, you know, at a Heiji they wear their alcasis one way, I have to wear my alcasis that way, and at Sojiji another way, I have to wear my alcasis there another way, and when I hold the priest's whisk, you must hold it this way there, and this way here, and very complicated stuff, you know. And you could think that this is very strict and very regimented, and 3:30, get up in the morning, march around, do all these ceremonies. And it would look like that if you didn't pay closer attention. But when you did pay closer attention, you saw that there was also a deep kindness there as well, behind the facade of all the things that needed to be done. There was a real feeling for the Buddhist past and a real feeling of respect for the temple and for all human beings. That's what the chief of the temple said to me after I finished one of the rituals and had tea with him. He said, Zazen, meditation, is for all people. It's to bring happiness to all people. That's why we do this. And one of the monks who was instructing me, he looked very severe, but when I talked to him, I realized that this is the first time he'd ever done this, first time he'd ever instructed anybody in this ceremony. He was really nervous. He was really trying to do good. And when I made a joke to him, you know, they give you this bright red, this is called an okesa. So for this one ceremony, they give you this bright red okesa to wear. And, I mean, obviously, you get to wear it during the ceremony, and then you give it back. And I said to this young man who was instructing us, it was a joke, you know. I said, oh, and we get to keep these? And he got very upset. You know, and at first you could think, oh, he's upset with me. But actually, the reason he was upset, it became quite clear right away, was he thought that I was serious. And he thought that he was going to have to tell me that, no, I don't get to keep this. And it was going to be so disappointing to me. And he just did not want to have to tell me that. And I said, no, it's a joke, it's a joke. And he was so relieved. So even at the big monasteries where on the surface, you know, you could see that everything looks very severe and complicated. In reality, it all comes from this spirit of just take care. Just do your best. Put your whole heart into it and take care out of respect for the past and out of kindness for the present. So, that's what I want. I wanted to tell you all these stories because I think that here in America, we tend to think of Buddhism in a very abstract way. You know, we tend to think of it as a kind of a combination of abstruse philosophy and hypertherapy. You know, as if meditation were some sort of technique that we could somehow, I don't know what we think, but we don't think of it as a just simply a warm-hearted way of life. We don't think of it that way, you know? We think of it as something that we're doing, that we're going to do this thing, and we're going to somehow make it work for us. I don't know what we think, but anyway, it's very different. It's very different in Asia, in general, in Japan in particular. And I think and I hope that it will be different here too. Because in the end, what brings us happiness and what brings our lives into focus in a good way is just that spirit of kindness, to be kind to ourselves and forgiving, you know, of ourselves, to respect others and be forgiving of others, to know that we're here now because of a long past that actually existed and exists still in us now, and we should respect that. I think we forget these things. And in forgetting these things, we lose track of what's most meaningful, important in our lives. So I think all of that is behind this text that I'm now finally getting to when it's time to stop. I thought that might happen. So I think what I'll do is just briefly share some of the words of the text with you and stop there, just to give you a flavor of the spirit of Dogen's language, because I think, as you'll see in a moment, when he talks about giving, when he talks about kind speech, he's talking about much more than what we usually mean by generosity and much more than what we usually mean by kindness. He's talking about a whole way of feeling your life, a whole different way of feeling time and feeling space and feeling identity. I think you'll see that. So he begins, "The Bodhisattva's four methods of guidance are giving, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action. Giving means non-greed. Non-greed means not to covet. Not to covet means not to curry favor. Even if you govern the four continents, you should always convey the correct teaching with non-greed. Giving means to give away unneeded belongings to someone you don't know, to offer flowers blooming on a distant mountain to the Buddha, or again, to offer treasures you had in your former lives to sentient beings. Whether it is of teaching or of material, each gift has its value and is worth giving. The question is not whether the gift is valuable, but what is the spirit. When you leave the way to the way, you attain the way. When you leave the way to the way, you attain the way. At the time of attaining the way is always left to the way. When treasure is left just as treasure, treasure itself becomes giving. You give yourself to yourself and others to others. The power of giving reaches to gods and human beings and even enlightened sages. When giving becomes actual, such power is immediately realized. Buddha once said, "When a person who practices giving goes to an assembly, people take notice." In other words, the person who practices giving is noticeable. You feel it. You should know that the mind of such a person communicates subtly with others. Therefore, give even a phrase or a verse of the truth. It will be a wholesome seed for this and other lifetimes. Give your valuables. Give even a penny or a blade of grass. It will be a wholesome root for this and other lifetimes. The truth can turn into valuables, and valuables can turn into the truth. This is all because the spirit of the giver is whole. Once a child gave sand, a grain of sand, to the Buddha, and as a result of this act of giving, he became King Ashoka in a later birth. Great people of the past were not greedy for reward. They only shared what they could. to launch a boat or build a bridge is an act of giving. Imagine if you went to work every day and thought, this is an act of giving. I'm going forth to my day to practice giving. Imagine if you came home and cleaned your house and thought, this is an act of giving. This is an act of ultimate generosity. I think that's how the monks in the temples, when they clean, that's the spirit that they're being trained in. To launch a boat or build a bridge is an act of giving. If you study giving closely, you see that to accept a body and to give up a body are both profound acts of giving. In other words, to be born is an act of giving, and to die is an act of giving. It's amazing. Who thinks about this? But somehow we have all accepted this human life. You know, we took it on for some reason. What? Why? What are we doing? We're going to give this up. How are we going to give that up? With what attitude will we give that up? Could we accept this life as an act of giving? Could we give up this life as an act of giving? Making a living and producing things can be nothing other than giving. To leave flowers to the wind, to leave birds to the seasons, are also acts of giving. Buddha said, if you are to practice giving to yourself, how much more so to your parents, spouse, and children? Therefore, you should know that to give to yourself is a part of giving. To give to your family is also giving. Even when you give just a particle of dust, you should rejoice in your own act, because in doing that, you have correctly transmitted the power of all the Buddhas, and you have, for the first time, performed an act of a bodhisattva. The mind of sentient beings is difficult to change. And when I read that line, it just really, and I think of the world we live in, I don't know whether to laugh or cry, you know. The mind of sentient beings is really difficult to change. Very, very, very difficult to change the way people behave in this world, you know. I think he knows that. But he says, it's very difficult to change. Modestly, he says, you should keep on changing the minds of sentient beings. From the first moment that you give them one particle to the moment that they become Buddhas, you should never stop trying to change the mind of sentient beings through the practice of giving. Mind is beyond measure. Things given are beyond measure. Mind transforms the gift, and the gift transforms the mind. Anyway, just to give you a flavor of this beautiful text that I love so much, and I hope that somehow or other you could see the connection between contemplating sickness, old age, and death, which is a traditional contemplation in Buddhism and in all religious life. And how could you find some tenderness and some willingness to be with that situation when, let's be honest, the first thing that happens when you hear these dismal stories is, I do not want to think about that. Don't tell me anymore about that. That is just too awful. And yet, it's all around us. Think how lonely the people who are in those conditions are, exactly because they fully know that the rest of us don't want to know about it. don't want to think about it. They know that. That's part of their pain. An act of giving is simply to let that into our lives. And I hope we can also see the connection between that and what I was talking about in Japanese temple life, just the warm-heartedness of taking care of your life as an act of giving. So anyway, this is not usually what you think of. You know, when you hear about Zen, you think it's some tough guy kind of thing, usually. Or am I wrong? Is that not what people... I don't know. I've often wondered why if you say, put up a big sign, you say, Vipassana retreat, 500 people come. If you put up another sign next door saying Zen retreat, 2 or 3 people come very tentatively, not sure that they, with 1 foot in the door and the other foot out the door. So I'm thinking maybe it's because of that, you know, that people think of it as some very tough guy kind of a thing. Anyway, that's what I wanted to talk tonight. So we have time for the famous questions and answers, which always amuses me in and of itself, you know, the whole idea of questions and answers. But please, anybody who has something to say, it doesn't have to be a question, and I won't necessarily give an answer, but let's talk. Yeah. So that's the problem, then, you're saying, that the problem is that it seems lonely, or it seems since people don't seem to understand it, you don't know whether you can validate it for yourself, even, yeah, right? Well, the surprising thing is that there's tons of people who are in just the same situation you're in. So it actually is not that, like, I'm always, you know, I actually am very active in teaching Jewish meditation. And when I teach, I always thought that if I did, I never wanted to do that, try to do it, it just sort of happened, you know, for various reasons. And I always thought that if I went into a synagogue and started saying anything about Jewish meditation, they would really get mad at me because I'm a Buddhist priest, you know. But it turns out not to be the case. They really appreciate it. And I commonly speak in synagogues and in Jewish venues because I don't know about other religions, but I guess it must be the same with other religions, which is to say that we're in a period now when, to the great surprise of probably all of us, it turns out that religion is very important. You know, I think we figured a few hundred years ago that we had gone beyond religion. Like, now we were smarter, we understood the superstitions of the past were no longer relevant, and we were going to have this wonderful humanistic world in which religion was not really going to be necessary anymore and nobody would need it. And so I think we're still kind of catching up to the idea that, oh, wait a minute, religion is more important than ever. So all the religions are trying to figure out what this means. And how can they take the best of what their religion offers and bring it into the contemporary world? Buddhism in America doesn't have that problem because it comes here as a brand new phenomenon. It, as I was implying, it has very little to do with Buddhism in Asia. I mean, it's based on the same teachings, but so it doesn't have that problem, but Judaism, Christianity, and maybe Islam also have that problem. So that's why there are lots going on in the Jewish world about how should we... And one of the things that's going on is meditation practice. There's a big movement, Jewish meditation movement, mindfulness movement, yoga in Judaism, all kind of things. You'd be surprised. If you just go on the web, you find lots of things going on. And there's a retreat centers that have silent Jewish meditation, and I lead a lot of Jewish meditation retreats for rabbis, you know. It turns out that conservative rabbis in America practice meditation. They go to meditation retreats. So I don't think you need to feel, and you could come to a Buddhist center and practice there, and it could be clear in your mind and the mind of anybody else that you're Jewish, and you go to synagogue if you wanted to do that. And it actually is not a problem. In fact, it's the opposite. Because I happen to know a lot of rabbis, actually. And rabbis are in a tough spot because most Jewish congregations are, and again, I assume this is true in Christianity as well, are community centers, economic centers, big real estate issues, almost impossible to do any spiritual practice. And so rabbis are really struggling with this and are looking for ways to survive this situation. So go to the Everyday Zen website and Google in, there's a Google function on the website. If you go to the teachings part and Google in Jewish meditation, and there's lots of talks on there that I've given about Jewish meditation and themes and holidays and all of that. And you'll get a flavor for what it would look like if you applied the insights of meditation practice to Judaism. So take heart. Take heart. It really is, you're on the right track, and it'll work out. Yeah. Other things. Yeah, that one is not so obvious, right? What it has to do with is helping a person and feeling that you're not helping them, that you and that person are one person. When you think about it, the idea of, it's like I was saying earlier in my talk about you know, if you have to talk about how you feel, you may be feeling less, you know? It's like that. If you have the idea that you're helping somebody else, it may be that you're not really helping. It may be that the only way that you help someone else is by becoming so close to that person that it's as if you're helping yourself. You don't have any feeling of helping another person. Yeah, so when we were in Rinzhou, when we were in the big monastery, Hoitsu Suzuki, it's maybe too complicated, but anyway, a dear friend of ours was there, Hoitsu Suzuki, and he's one of the officials now of this big monastery, and so he came, gave us a special evening of just hanging out. We sat and had tea with him. And there's one of Dogen's famous words is grandmother mind. And someone asked him, "What? I don't understand grandmother mind. Can you explain grandmother mind?" And he said, "Grandmother mind is when you have so much imagination that another person's feeling is your feeling. You feel another person's feeling as if it were your own. Can you imagine? Like that. Imagine trying to benefit someone as if the way that they felt was the way that was your feeling. Imagine just talking to someone and totally taking in their feeling so that it really is yours. You really do feel that at that moment." And I do think that that is the best way that human beings can help each other. I know that I work a lot with caregivers for the dying. And as we talk about this a lot in that work, you know, we say the best thing that you could do to help somebody who's dying is not by figuring out some great wisdom to impart to them or something like that, but to really feel their feeling, because it's so lonely at the end of your life when no one else is willing to go there. But if you're willing to go there and really feel the person's feeling, it's such a gift, and I think that's always true in any situation, if you could really feel a person's feeling. And then, you know, just like if you yourself were in pain, you would do something to alleviate your pain without feeling like you were doing some big deal. You just do it because it's natural. In the same way, you'd help another person based on that feeling. So that's what he means by identity action. Yeah. So it's not, like I say, not what we would usually think of. You know, it's a different view of life. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, yes, right. Yeah, well, see, yeah, well, and you know, yeah, and it should be discouraged when someone doesn't have the training to know how to do that. And it makes sense that it would be discouraged. In our culture, we have no clue that such a thing could be possible. Because psychology is based on a scientific, materialistic model. You can't take in another person's feeling on that model. That's a religious act. Now, insofar as psychology, I think nowadays psychology is in flux also, and it becomes often overlaps with religious life. I mean, my guess is there's a few psychologists sitting here in the room, and that's testament to the fact that, you know, psychology and religion are now in many ways overlapping. And so then it becomes possible with religious practice. But it is an aspect of religious culture, which includes training and all kinds of protections and supports for that, making that possible. So it does make sense, you know, that it would be that way in psychology. And it's not something we would complain about. We would just say, what's a different model in a different system, and if you do spiritual practice and you become trained in it in some serious way, different things become possible in a way that you can relate to others in your life. And you know, one of the main trainings in Buddhism is the training in compassion, and it's a profound training. It doesn't just mean be nice to other people or be sympathetic to their plight. It means much more than that. It's a much more profound insight and training than that, although that's included in it, but it's much more than that. And so then, if you have training like that, things become possible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think, I mean, maybe I was, but I think that's true for all of us as well. It's an interesting problem when you think about it. Like, what is the reality status of the past? Where is it? You know what I mean? Like, we can at least on a scientific basis, we can say this room is real in some way, you know, although that's a problem as well. How real is it, in what way is it real, and so on. But the past, like, where is that? Where is the past? How can we verify it? Well, we have different artifacts and different kinds of evidence. But when you think about it, really the past is the past for you, right? I mean, your past is the past for you. Physical manifestations of it are the least of it. And so it's as if, like that little story I told, it's as if Anna maybe didn't remember about the polio, or somehow the past changed for her because of her present circumstances. And so, for example, like this other story I told about the guy whose daughter was killed in an auto accident, crossing a street, I think, and he, that's a fixed event in his life that has a meaning and a place in his heart that's extremely painful. If he changes spiritually and forgives himself, the past will have changed. That event will feel different, and it will live differently in him than it presently does. And so many things that we remember differently later on, right? We remember things we didn't remember, or we remember things differently than we remember them at some point. And goodness knows, you know, just take something as simple as, you know, the history of the Civil War. Well, why is it that they write another book about that every generation? You know? Because the past is changing. It has a different meaning. It's literally, the meaning of the Civil War is different with every generation. And that's true of every single historical event that ever happened. And certainly even more true of personal history. So all of time is dynamic. It's all in flux depending on what happens next. The past is changing according to our present engagement. So that's why if somebody says, well, I'm too old to change, or because such and such and so and so happened to me, it's hopeless. What that is a choice of the present in disguise as a fact of the past. Right? So there's always hope, you know, when you realize this, that how true this is. There's always hope for a real change of heart and a real revolution in one's living and in the whole world, actually, because of that. So it's good news, don't you think? Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And I was reflecting on that, and I understand, I think I misheard you saying, but often it seems to be the opposite. Like,
yeah.
I feel it's essential to help me to know my experience and unfold my experience.
Yes.
So
yeah, well, thank you for bringing that up, because I was not saying that, I was not trying to create a new rule, which now, the new rule which says, do not ever speak about your feelings or anything you've experienced. I was saying that sometimes, often, speaking about our feelings has the effect of distancing us from them. But you're pointing out that sometimes it's the opposite. And I think that's true. Sometimes it is the opposite. And goodness knows, as someone who has a very serious and incorrigible writing habit, I'm not somebody who is aspiring to go beyond language. I have a tremendous interest in language and respect for language. But I think that the question of language and description and concept and thought is much more rich and complicated than we usually think it is. So, yeah, there are times in which, in fact, in a lot of the work that I do, I encourage people to do journaling and stuff like that, because it really does, under the right circumstances and with the right attitude, it has a tremendous benefit in helping us to understand and feel. Sometimes we don't feel what we feel. Sometimes language unlocks what we feel, and certainly literature has that, poetry and so on has that property. So yeah, thank you for bringing that out, because otherwise, see, this is the trouble with talking about anything, that if you say something, then it could easily seem like you're saying something more or less than you're saying. So that's why it's good when someone says, well, wait a minute, if that's, did you really mean that? No, I didn't mean that, actually. Even though I said it, I meant it, but I didn't mean like that's the end of the story and there's no more to the story than that. So sometimes I think you should give a talk and then stop, and then give the opposite talk. And that would maybe complete the picture, you know. Yeah. Yes.
Might take away from not speaking So that's what made me think of what I was going to ask you now. I wonder about in Western Buddhism, in the Western world, and I've noticed that what I've wondered about is the word mindfulness. And I've noticed how it seems, it just seems to me like, you know, typical of our country to take a word and because it was maybe successful or seemed to have meaning, all of a sudden it's kind of like booming and all different, you know, advertisements or mindful clothes, for example, or mindful, you know, mindful cars. And I don't know, it brings a little bit, and I don't mean not quite love talking, but it does bring a little sadness to me of how the words are watered down. And then suddenly I just want to not use those words and find a new one to mean what it meant in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I just would love a comment from you on that concept or that thought that I've had.
Yes, well, that's what happens, huh? What are you going to do? You know, that's what happens. Yeah. So things become fads and trendy, you know. That's what happens. But this has nothing to do with it, but I just thought I would share with you now. I was thinking today, I've never been very impressed with fashion. You know? I'm not a person who's like interested in fashion, but today it hit me how profound fashion actually is. I mean clothing. I mean literally fashion. Because fashion is a meditation on the human body, right? Different clothes make the body express a different body. So it's like throughout history, people have been thinking about the human body is like an image in our minds, right? We all have a body the image of a human body in our mind. And throughout history, human beings have been contemplating our own body. It's like we've been meditating on our own body for millions of years. And that's what fashion is. It's like different expressions of this is what the human body should be or could be, or this is how I'm thinking about it now. So in a way, I guess you could say the same thing about other sorts of trends. You know, annoying as it can be to see terms debased and so on, I suppose in some way it's all of us collectively trying to figure out what matters to us or what it means to be a human being, what does it mean to be conscious? And the idea of mindfulness is a kind of new idea in our culture. And so we keep turning it around in different ways, and ways that are not always so pleasing or successful or make much sense, but that's what we're doing. We're all doing that together. So, I don't know. The world is very strange now with all the, you know, the way things can become viral, like they say, like the word viral, you know, like where did that come from? That's like this year maybe, or 2 years ago, right? But now everybody's viral with the word viral. So, I don't know. We could all just stay home. Maybe we should. Even when you go to long meditation retreats, you know, they tend to be over at the end. And then what? Then here you are again, you know. So I think that there really is no other way but to take care of the temple, right? Which is the whole world. And, you know, clean and polish and practice giving and keep your fingers crossed and hope for the best. Okay, last thing, yeah.
Well, I have to comment that I think it was about 2 years ago in November when you were here, and most of the talks about cleaning the toilet.
Oh, really?
For your wife, you were doing, there was something there was something going on in the hall and the bathroom, and maybe you hadn't been doing that.
Oh.
So I was just frustrated for it.
You know, it's so funny that you, it is so funny that you bring that up, because today I was really upset that I did not clean the toilet before I left, because the water went out in our house, you know, and it was pretty mess situation, and finally the water came back, and so I said, oh, before I get on the airplane, I'm going to clean all the toilets, so that you know, my wife, who is, should never have to clean toilets, she's too nice a person for this. I thought I would do this, but then yesterday there was a big mushroom cloud on the horizon, and I thought, what is that? And it turned out that there was, I don't know if you heard about this, yeah, there was a gigantic explosion in Greenbrae, 38 houses were blown up. A PG&E line exploded, and it was a huge fireball, and 38 houses burned up. So far, they're only saying 4 people died, but probably that number will grow. You may wonder what that has to do with my toilets. Well, Greenbrae is between where I live and the airport. And so when I realized that was going on and still going on, I thought to myself, I better go right now to the airport because there could be gigantic traffic and I'll miss the plane and I'll never be at Nalanda West talking to you now. So I didn't clean the toilets. I jumped in the car and went to the airport. But I was really upset about that today. Yeah. So it's funny that I was thinking about that last time. I guess I have a toilet issue. Isn't spiritual practice fun? You gotta love it. Thank you very much for coming, everybody. And maybe we'll see some of you tomorrow at the retreat. Take care. See you next time.